VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Saudi Arabia insists that Iranian weapons were used in last weekend's devastating attack on its oil industry. And U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says that means the responsibility for the assault lies squarely with Tehran, and he called it an act of war. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports on Pompeo's message as he traveled to Saudi Arabia.
As he flew to the kingdom, Pompeo dismissed claims by Iranian-backed rebels in Yemen that they were behind the attack.
It doesn't matter. This was an Iranian attack.
The Saudis are stopping just shy of directly accusing Iran, but say it unquestionably sponsored the assault. Iran denies it and warns if the U.S. attacks in retaliation, it will face an immediate response. President Trump says he hasn't decided just what to do.
If we have to do something, we'll do it without hesitation.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
And asked about possible U.S. military action against Iran, President Trump said it was a great sign of strength not to attack.
There's the ultimate option, and there are options a lot less than that. And we'll see. We're in a very powerful position. Right now, we're in a very, very powerful position.
You say the ultimate option. Are you talking
about? No, I'm saying the ultimate option, meaning go in. War. No, I'm not talking about that ultimate option, no.
At the moment, it seems that neither Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu nor his challenger Benny Gantz is poised to put together a ruling government coalition after the national election. But what seems certain is that Netanyahu's grip on power and even his political future are now in doubt. Final elections may come by Thursday. At the moment, again, it seems that neither Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu nor his challenger, Benny Gantz, is poised to put together a ruling government after Wednesday's elections. This is VOA News. The U.S. Federal Reserve cut interest rates by a quarter point. It's a move tied in part to President Trump's trade war with China. In its announcement, the Fed promised to act as appropriate to keep the U.S. economy growing, but did not pledge further rate cuts as demanded by Mr. Trump, a frequent critic of Jerome Powell, his own appointee as Fed chairman. Powell says he does not foresee any pattern of further rate cuts on the horizon.
If the economy does turn down, then a more extensive sequence of rate cuts could be appropriate. We don't see that. It's not what we expect, but we would certainly follow that path if it became appropriate.
A top NASA manager is casting doubt on the U.S. Space Agency's ability to land American astronauts on the moon by the year 2024. AP correspondent Shelley Adler.
It was a goal set by the Trump administration and announced by Vice President Pence in March.
President Trump has relaunched the National Space Council, and at the council's inaugural meeting in October, we unanimously approved a recommendation to instruct NASA to return American astronauts to the moon.
But Kenneth Bowersox, a former space shuttle and space station commander, told a congressional subcommittee he would not make a wager on that 2024 date, adding many things like funding and technical challenges need to come together. He acknowledges also there's a lot of risk in making that date. Shelley Adler, Washington.
Greta Thunberg, the noted young advocate for climate change, was back on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. for a straight day. AP's Ed Donahue.
The 16-year-old from Sweden told a House committee she didn't want to use her time to talk about the results of a report on global warming.
I don't want you to listen to me. I want you to listen to the scientists. And I want you to unite behind the science.
Thunberg has staged weekly demonstrations calling for world leaders to step up their efforts against climate change. While in Washington, she met with former President Barack Obama.
Do you know about fist bumping? Do you believe in fist bumping? You can do the boom.
The Trump administration has cut back many Obama-era environmental protections. Ed Donahue, Washington.
The Trump administration is challenging vehicle mileage and emission standards in the state of California. The Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom calls a case of White House bullying.
That's not free enterprise. That's not about states. That's about bullying and intimidation. That's unethical.
And Mr. Trump has emphasized that he wants California's rules rolled back. More at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The UN Security Council is told that peace in South Sudan remains precarious, but progress is being made.
The recent visit of Dr. Riek Machar to Juba at the invitation of President Salva Kiir was an important development. The challenge remains, of course, is to show tangible results.
David Shearer is the UN Special Representative for South Sudan. At least 28 persons, mostly children, died early Wednesday from fire in Liberia's capital, Monrovia. Kenya is hosting the Organization of African Trade Unions Conference, and patients feel the pain from Zimbabwe doctor's strike.
I love Zimbabwe, and my colleagues would agree with me that they also love Zimbabwe. However, it doesn't negate the fact that when the economy is deteriorating like this, we are forced to think outside the box.
That was Dr. Peter Magumbiye before he went missing last week. A Guinean opposition leader says he will not take part in next month's parliamentary elections. And a Moroccan journalist is in jail for allegedly having sex outside of marriage. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Special Representative and head of the UN mission in South Sudan says peace in South Sudan remains precarious, but progress is being made. David Shearer told the UN Security Council on Wednesday that rebel leader Riek Machar's visit to Juba last week at the invitation of President Kiir was an important development, but he said the challenge of receiving tangible results towards lasting peace still remains.
The recent visit of Dr. Riek Machar to Juba at the invitation of President Salva Kiir was an important development. The face-to-face meetings, which many of us believe are fundamental to moving forward, provided an opportunity to discuss critical unresolved parts of the peace agreement. Importantly, they recommitted to forming the transitional government, a positive step because it maintains the momentum of peace and bolsters confidence among South Sudanese. The challenge remains, of course, is to show tangible results. And three areas in particular require progress. First, the unification of security forces. Of the 35 cantonment sites planned, 23 are now occupied by opposition forces and 10 by the government. But many sites still lack amenities, and protection risks may arise in nearby villages if these shortfalls continue. Secondly, the Independent Boundaries Commission was unable to reach consensus on the number of states and boundaries. Resolution via a referendum, we believe, is implausible given the expense and the time required. Third, the agreement provides for five vice presidents, each leading a cluster of cabinet portfolios. 2 months out from a transitional government, these still need to be determined. And finally, I should mention that the non-signatories to the agreement need to move from violent opposition, for which they've been involved, to constructive participation. Mr. President, 1 year on, peace is beginning to pay dividends for the citizens of South Sudan. The formation of the transitional government provides an opportunity to lift our gaze from immediate challenges and look over the horizon towards elections that are expected at the end of the three-year transition. Criminality remains a serious problem, with random attacks on civilians, commonly by unpaid soldiers and former combatants. Mr. President, the bottom line is simply this. While the situation for many South Sudanese citizens remains bleak, the last year of peace has kick-started a transformative process that is improving people's lives. This could not have happened without the ceasefire or the confidence generated by the peace process. If South Sudan's leaders ever needed inspiration to reconcile and work in the country's best interests, they can find it under the trees and in the tukuls, where communities are coming together to build peace. The peace process remains precarious, but progress is being made. Maintaining momentum is the absolute key, and that depends very much on the continuing goodwill of the parties, as well as the collective and unrelenting focus of international friends to support the formation of a transitional government.
David Shearer is the Special Representative and head of the UN mission in South Sudan. He briefed the UN Security Council on Wednesday. Fear is crippling Zimbabwe's already struggling health system as doctors and patients alike are staying away. The disappearance of an outspoken young doctor who led a strike for higher public sector wages has only made the situation more dire. Anita Powell reports from Harare.
If there is one thing that unites doctors and patients in Zimbabwe's ailing public health system, it's fear. The system is struggling to function amid a shattered economy and triple-digit inflation. Administrators, doctors, and patients told VOA that hospitals often have a hard time getting supplies. And government doctors say they can't make ends meet on an average salary worth just $100 a month. But as they have learned, speaking out has consequences. That became evident this week in the disappearance of Peter Magombeyi, a junior doctor who led a strike over public sector pay. He went missing over the weekend. Colleagues say he had received threats from people he identified as being members of Zimbabwe's Central Intelligence Organization. A different kind of fear afflicts patients. Dorcas Nyototi, who is 36, says she hasn't seen a doctor in decades, and not for lack of trying. When her feet, afflicted by childhood polio, give her pain, she grits her teeth or takes over-the-counter drugs. She says that's because every time she's approached a hospital, she's quoted terrifying prices, despite her lack of income.
I feel pain, but there's nothing I can do, because this is the world I am. This is my country.
And fear is what kept teacher Milka Gwatiringa from seeking help for more than a decade, as an abdominal tumor grew to a staggering 12 kilograms before it was successfully removed by doctors at the nation's largest hospital.
I had so many fears, so I was not willing to come. I was very much afraid.
The fear wasn't just over costs. Dr. Shingurai Meki, the urologist who led Gwatiringa's surgery, says patients also fear the uncertainty of the poorly funded public hospitals.
As a lot of patients or a lot of people are suffering in their homes, they are scared, they are not sure what is going to happen to them. So she is a wonderful success story, which we wish everyone to be aware.
VOA met with the strike leader, Dr. Magombeyi, last week, before he went missing. At the time, he was blunt about Zimbabwe's challenges and his own.
I love Zimbabwe, and my colleagues would agree with me that they also love Zimbabwe. We love our country. It's beautiful. However, it doesn't negate the fact that when the economy is deteriorating like this, we are forced to think outside the box.
2 days later, Magombeyi was gone. Fellow doctors have marched in Harare, demanding his return. Anita Powell, VOA News, Harare.
Kenya has urged the Organization of Trade Unions Unity to help foster solidarity in Africa. Speaking in Nairobi during the Union's General Assembly meeting, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta challenged the Trans-Africa Union to advocate for immigrant labor, saying it strengthens the bond amongst African countries. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
According to Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta, most Africans working in foreign countries do not have a conducive working environment. Kenyatta has called on collaboration of African countries so as to better lives of its people and create job opportunities for all.
Let us work together for our unity. It is very sad, it is very disheartening to see our sons and daughters struggle, lose life, crossing the Mediterranean, being humiliated in foreign lands because we cannot get together and grow our own prosperity and provide employment and a future and hope for them. I truly believe that Kenya does not have the answer, but I do believe that together with our African brothers and sisters, we can find the answer and the solutions if we come together. We are not each other's enemy.
Mr. Kenyatta asked the organization to be at the forefront in pushing for free movement of goods, people, labor, and capital across the entire continent. He says the labor unions in African countries should guard the fundamental rights of its workers.
African labor organizations must also be at the forefront of advocating for the free movement, goods, persons, across our entire continent. This free movement within Africa was a large part of the dream that informed the formation of the Organization of African Trade Union Unity in the year 1973. And this should not be forgotten.
On the other hand, the president of the organization's trade unions unit, Francis Atwoli, who is the host of the assembly, said that the African nations has a lot of labor and industrial problems, asking the government for support.
We have strived to bring our people on the continent together, and the purpose of us having maintained the organization of the African Trade Union Unity is that because Africa has unique labor and industrial relations problem, unlike those that are in developed world. That Your Excellency, we require your support to this organization, and we need to have for a while to an official government budget allocation.
The Union Secretary General and Algerian Arzik Massoud said that the union's aim is to improve the working conditions of workers.
We want to play a big role in Africa through the implementation of African different programs and also ILO programs. Your Excellency, we hope that you will support our organization, which is a baby of African Union, in the interest of stability, development and independence of the African labor movement.
The assembly has brought together 54 countries across the continent. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 19th. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. At least 28 persons, mostly children, died early Wednesday from fire at an Islamic school in the Painesville area of Liberia's capital, Monrovia. The 27 children and their teacher were boarding at the Quran Memorization Center run by the United Dawah Umar Mosque. Moses Gazia will report from Monrovia.
It was a morning of weeping as parents and relatives cried out for their loved ones, mostly children who were about to complete memorizing the entire Holy Quran. The Liberian Red Cross and National Disaster Management Agency were busy all morning Wednesday to recover the corpses. Augustine Tamba is the Deputy Managing Director for Operation of the National Disaster Management Agency.
The country is engulfed with a tumult or disaster that have ravaged the life of 28 persons. As to the exact cause of this fire outbreak, is yet under investigation. But what we are doing is that a proper disposal of those bodies as a result of the fire incident is what we are doing now. The details of what led to the fire will be investigated by a joint committee.
Families too watching the bodies of their children as they were being placed at the back of a pickup truck. Muslim cleric Iman Hossan So lost three of his own children in the accident.
While we understand, because we received a call around 1 o'clock in the night that fire caught the building. When we reached there, we saw the damage and we saw the dead body. But what actually caused the fire right now is unknown to us.
Almost everyone who visited the scene of the accident early Wednesday morning tried to hold back their tears as they viewed the remains of the deceased children, most of them between the ages of 12 to 18 years old. Painesville City Mayor Pam Besha Taylor was in shock.
I can't speak right now. There is nothing I can say right now. It's a complete tragedy. Moses, there isn't anything much I can say right now. You can see my composure. This is very, very sad.
President George Weah visited the scene of the accident before attending the funeral in the capital, Monrovia. He described the incident as a disaster for the entire country.
28 is too much. It's a tragedy, a disaster for us. I want you to take heart. Only Allah knows what happened. Only our government, our deepest sympathy. It's a tough time for us. You can see us. Most especially one that closer to this family. How valuable our children are to us. Whatever happened, only Allah.
Also speaking was the Grand Mufti of the Muslim religion in Liberia, Sheikh Abubakar Sumaro, who called on Muslims in the bereaved families not to be sad.
This is one of the way of the trial of Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Almighty Allah have to try you. Almighty Allah have to know the level of your belief. Islamic creed told us that we should be in a position to receive such thing at all times.
The cause of the fire is yet to be established.
The police say they are working alongside the National Fire Service to investigate the incident. Moses Gazil, VOA News, Monrovia.
A Guinean opposition leader says the opposition will boycott next month's parliamentary elections. The elections should have taken place in January this year, but were postponed indefinitely. The opposition has accused President Alpha Conde of delaying the elections as a pretext to have a third term after his current and constitutionally mandated final term ends in 2020. Sidya Touré is the leader of the opposition Union of Republican Forces Party of Guinea.
Opposition party is not going to this election as it is organized by Alpha Conte. You know, the president has only one and the same target, is to have a third mandate. If he cannot get it by the constitution, he wants to get it by a full parliamentary election. In Guinea, if you have two-thirds of the parliament, you can change the constitution. So this is what he wants to do. And because of that, he's not respecting any kind of law concerning the electoral process.
But how come the opposition has continually argued that the president had failed to hold the election? So the president now says, okay, we are going to have the election. How come you don't want to participate now?
Nobody has to argue to organize the election. In any kind of country, if you have an institution, you have a time to organize the election. In 2018, those elections had to be held in October of last year. We didn't do it. And if you want to do it now, you have election law in Guinea who say you have to take 3 months to have a registration of elector. They decided to make it firstly in 45 days, and now they say we will do it in 25 days. If you know Guinea, we have no electricity, and you have many problems like that. So if we don't come to the regular situation to respect the electoral law in Guinea, we're not going to the election. And don't forget, when Alpha came in power in 2010, we got to rise during 3 years to have a legislative election in Guinea. 3 years we was in it because he doesn't want to do it.
I talked to the Minister of Information. He said the president promised that the elections will be held by the end of the year. Do you know the timeline now for the elections?
You know, in Guinean law, the president has no power to give the election, the date of the election, because that's depending on the electoral commission. And the electoral commission have electoral law, we have to applicate it. If he decide to do it himself and the president of the electoral commission say, okay, I will do what the president say, we say we should not election anymore. This is something different.
If you do not go to the elections, say in November or December, aren't you indirectly handing the so-called third term to President Alpha Conde?
Let me explain again. The fact that we didn't have the election in October depends on that the president didn't give money to the Electoral Commission to organize the election. He decided to do it himself. We think that two things are totally different. We have legislative election for parliamentary election, and the presidential election is totally different. If we didn't have presidential election in June 2020, we'll have no president. We'll go to transition, absolutely.
Sidya Touré is the leader of the Opposition Union of Republican Forces Party of Guinea. You are speaking with us from the capital, Conakry. 12 senators have been elected to represent Rwanda's 4 provinces. Only 4 of the 12 are women. Eugene Uwimana has followed the Rwandan senatorial elections and has this update.
The election of the 12 senators followed nearly 2 months of campaigning. The new senators plus 2 more from public and private universities and higher learning institutions will serve in Ghana's 3rd Senate. Professor Kalisa Mbanda, chairman of the National Electoral Commission, says the senatorial electoral process went well. Everything has run as predicted. We have not encountered any difficulties. Candidates have campaigned in peace, unity, and harmony. They respect the time. We are sure that these elected senators are really going to effectively serve the public. The Senate is made up of 26 members, including 12 members who represent the country's 4 provinces and the city of Kigali and are picked through electoral colleges and 8 senators appointed by the President of the Republic. The Consultative Forum of Political Organizations designates 4 senators, 2 from public and private universities and higher learning institutions. All elected senators say they have at heart issues to advocate for. Professor Cyprien Yomugabo represents the institutions of higher learning. Now our voices as teachers, we undoubtedly arrive at a higher level, and to address challenges in education means to save the nation. The Rwandan government provided the full funding for these elections with 200 million Rwandan francs, over $200,000. Rwanda has the highest number of women participating in parliament. This time, only 4 women were elected in the Senate. Ejen Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Moroccan journalist Haya Raisouni is in jail in Morocco for what the authorities say are the crimes of getting an abortion and having sex outside of marriage. But Raisouni says the charges are a retribution for her critical coverage of the Moroccan government. Donya Boris, a spokesperson for Moroccan Collective, says the issue highlights 2 laws that are an impediment to women's rights in Morocco.
Forbid abortion pushes women to try to have abortion outside of medical context, which puts their health to really high risk. Some use traditional medicine, some just... We hear a lot of stories of a young girl that would stab herself or that would, really put her life in really dangerous positions. The society is really, really hard on women that try to have abortions, even mothers. Or women in a regular situation, according to the society, that would be married and wouldn't want to have more children, have an accident or something like that. Doctors do not perform it. Women don't have any control over their body.
It sounds like that also applies to sex outside of marriage. It's against the law for women to have sex outside of marriage. Is that correct?
It is for men as well. But the fact is that, for example, if a woman gets an abortion because she's been raped, first of all, if she needs to prove the rape, if she's unable to prove the rape, she falls also into the Article 490 that says all persons of different sex who, not being bound by the bonds of marriage, have intercourse with one another shall be punishable by imprisonment for a term of 1 month to 1 year. The problem in this article is that the law is supposed to give boundaries to individuals. Like, look, don't cross this line, otherwise you're a criminal. But around this area, you have a personal freedom that you can exert. We don't have this space of freedom in Morocco.
It's difficult because in order to defend herself, Ms. Raisouni must say, no, I didn't have an abortion. The problem is that that's not the point. The point is that these things should not be an affront to women's rights.
Absolutely. It shouldn't be criminalized at all. That's the whole point.
They're using her her gender against her almost.
It's always women in Morocco are always victims.
That was a Moroccan journalist speaking to Ricky Shryak from Rabat. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Moroccan journalist. That's it for this Thursday, September 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I am James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.